Well, I invite you to turn your Bibles to a very interesting book, the book of Esther. The book of Esther. If you flip your Bible open, you'll probably, to the midway point, you'll probably find the book of Psalms. If you go towards the front, you'll find the 40 chapters of the book of Job. You go right before that, you can find the 10-chapter book of Esther. Esther, the name, is very similar in Hebrew to the phrase, I will hide. I will hide. That's important. Esther has a different name mentioned in there, and you can see that as you read through when she's introduced. But she's renamed Esther. I will hide. Now, why is that important? Because here is a book where God is hiding. Go ahead and read the 10 chapters. Count up how many times God is mentioned. You know how many times it is? Zero. How many times is prayer mentioned? Zero. God is not mentioned. Praying to God is not mentioned. Worshiping God is not mentioned. Anywhere in this whole book. And you think, how could a book be in our Bible that doesn't mention God? Maybe there's times in your life when God seems to be hiding. When you're looking around, you're wondering, where is God in this? Maybe you're shaking your fist. God, where are you? Can't you see what's going on? Can't you see the hurt? Can't you see the chaos? God, why aren't you showing up? There's part of the deep part of us that cries out and says, God, I want to see you. I want to see you, God. I need to see you, God. Esther is a book for you if you've cried out and said, God, I need to see you. I will hide. That's really what God said at the end of Deuteronomy as Moses was being told by God that his life was nearing its final days. God warned Moses in Deuteronomy 31, 14, 15, 16, 18, that range. And God is saying, the people are going to rebel. The people are going to reject me. The people are going to experience great devastation. God predicted and foretold the exile that would occur and is the framework for which the book of Esther is being told. The people are in captivity. Why? Because they rejected God. And God's promises are true. God allowed them to be punished. But even there in exile, God is at work. The book of Esther is about God who's not seen, God who's not talked about, is at work behind the scenes. God is doing something miraculous. And page after page, as you read through the book of Esther, you're forced by the absence of the name of God to say, don't they realize that had to be God doing that? Time and time again, the sovereign hand of God is at work in this situation, in the Jewish community, in Esther and her cousin or uncle Mordecai. God is doing something. Why aren't they talking about it? Because that's what we tend to do, isn't it? We don't see God. We ignore God. Maybe we need to sing that song over and over and over again today and this week and this month, saying, God, I want to see you. I want to see you high and lifted up. I want to see you in your glory. I want to see what you're doing. I want to see what you're doing in these areas that are so painful right now, when relationships seem to be crumbling, when the world seems to be in this great time of upheaval, when forces of evil seem to be rising up and causing much harm across the globe. When it seems like lies are being propagated and believed and strengthened, when all that seems to be going on, the God who hides is at work. Now I'm going to try in my best to go quickly through the storyline so we can get to the application at the end of it. But Esther, it starts off with explaining the situation, but really the history of the time is really important. It's about 100 years after the first wave of exiles were taken into captivity. It's about not quite 500 years before Christ. It's a time when the nation, the kingdom of Persia, is ruling from India all the way over to Ethiopia and parts of the eastern southern edges of Europe. The kingdom of Persia is starting to have a little trouble, though, on its fringes. The Greeks are arising. It's shortly after the time frame of the Battle of Marathon. Or some of you maybe have seen a movie about 300 Greeks who stood up against the whole Persian army. Hollywood would like to make a film about that. It's that time when there's chaos on the edges of the kingdom. And so the king throws a party, a gala, a festival, to try to convince himself and his nobles, his governors, his people, that he's really something special after all. Don't be afraid. Don't think things are crumbling. So a 180-day party and then a 7-day feast of great opulence to try to say, I'm great. I'm king. Look at me. And what he does is cause people to recognize God is the only great one here. What I find fascinating, those of you who know your history, the Shah of Iran, in the mid-70s, through a party like this. Look that up in your history books. The Shah of Iran tried to duplicate this, and it had similar results for him as it did for this king. So the king is introduced in chapter 1, and he tries to show his greatness by causing his queen to come and parade in front of all his drunken friends, and the queen refuses, and so the queen is deposed, and then we have a new search for a new queen, and that's in chapter 2 when we see Esther introduced. Esther is a Jew. Her uncle Mordecai is a Jew. They were carried into exile in this land of Babylon, then when the kingdoms changed, renamed Persia. And here we have Jewish people living in exile, after the time that many had already returned to Jerusalem. And you have to ask, why are they still in Persia? Why didn't they go back to Jerusalem? What are they doing here? And what's the significance of the date that's listed? It's the date right before the Passover, when Mordecai is introduced. And if we read it from a Jewish perspective, we'd say, well, what's he doing there? Why is he in Persia? Why isn't he in Jerusalem? Why isn't he preparing to worship at Passover? We see that these Jewish people who are introduced to us are Jewish people who have compromised. They're living where they shouldn't still be living. They're becoming Persian in their cultural lifestyles. They don't seem to have any trouble engaging in this beauty pageant that's going to be held in Mordecai seems to be okay with his niece going and having a one-night trial run with the king. There's all sorts of things going on. You're going, this isn't quite right. Why have they compromised? Then you ask the question, could God use people like this? Could God use people who have compromised, who aren't following Torah as well as they should, who are eating impure food and not standing up against the restriction of marrying Gentiles? Could God use compromised people? It's a good question for those of us who have experienced compromise to ask. Could God use compromised people? People who have struggled in different ways to follow God, people who have struggled with separating from impure culture, people who have moral ambiguity. Could God use people like that? Could God use Esther, which means God hides? Could God use you? Could God use you? If God is hiding, he's not doing a very good job of it. For the beauty pageant is held, and Esther, The Jew who's hiding her identity, her Jewish ancestry, is chosen to be the new queen. She is elevated to the queen of the empire. The king is smitten with her. Some translations say that the king was attracted to her, but the word is love. The king loved her. The king loved her. She is elevated. And another thing happens in that chapter 2 at the end of it, just snuck in there as a little parenthesis, a little side note. Oh yeah, Mordecai just happened to be in the right spot when two rebellious guards were talking about trying to assassinate the king. Just so happened that Mordecai overheard it, and Mordecai was able to tell Esther, who's now the queen, and Esther was able to tell the king, and the king was able to stifle this assassination attempt. Just so happened, and then something passed over and quickly forgotten, it seems like. You turn to chapter 3, and the main villain of the story is introduced. His name is Haman. He's not a Persian. He's actually an Agagite. Why does that matter? An Agagite is an ancestor of King Agag, a Canaanite. Just so happens that King Agag was supposed to have been killed by Saul, but Saul didn't. So Solomon, the priest, had to come and take care of it. When people don't do what God tells them to do, there's consequences. And throughout the Bible narrative, you see this conflict that exists between God's people and people who are aligning themselves with evil, with different aspects of Satan's rising up to try to destroy God's people. And here is another indication of that. This Agagite, Haman, is in a position of power and is doing all he can to destroy the people of God. For some reason, Haman was Satan's instrument in this time. And he is so enraged at Mordecai's refusal to kneel before him and honor him that he encourages the king, and the king is a bit of a drunken pushover, he encourages the king to enact an edict that all the Jewish people should be destroyed, annihilated. Where does that come from? Someone hating another person is not that uncommon. But someone saying, I so hate that person that I want every single person in his family line and all of his ancestry, all of the lineage that he's part of, to be wiped off the planet. That's the devil talking. And whether it's Haman or Hitler, it's the same source of that type of racism and that type of anti-Semitism and that type of trying to destroy God's people. And when that rears its head, we have to ask, is God going to do something? Is God hiding? Is God somewhere in the story? Is God able to somehow act so that evil doesn't triumph? It certainly looks like evil is triumphing here. Haman is elevated to number 2 in the land. He has great power, great authority, great influence over the king. And so, a little play on the words and a play on the situation. Haman has the dice rolled and a date picked on which to destroy the Jewish people. The Jewish word for that dice is the word pur, P-U-R. The word pur. Throwing the dice. Chance. Coincidence. Something that just happened. Something that certainly God wasn't part of, was he? Certainly God wasn't in that, was he? Certainly God's not there. Certainly God is hiding. Poor. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. Chapter 4, you find Mordecai trying to help save his people. He gets a message to Queen Esther, And eventually there's a dialogue that takes place through couriers. In chapter 4, in verse 12, it reads, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai that she really had no access to the king. In fact, it was unlawful for her to go into the king's presence without having first been summoned. Mordecai says to her, in chapter 4, verse 13, do not think that because you are in the king's house alone, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. That's an amazing statement of faith in the midst of a great, great danger. An edict has gone around the kingdom that Jewish people are to be annihilated, and Mordecai is trying to get Queen Esther to do something about it, and she's saying, I can't, I can't, I can't. And he's saying, you've got to do something or you're going to be destroyed. And even if you don't, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. That statement seems to be totally out of context from what is going on around it. But in the middle of that, he's able to say, I know that God's going to deliver us. I know that God will rescue his people. I know that God has got a plan. I know that God is here. I don't see him. He's hiding. But I trust him. I trust him. So Esther is moved by this, and she is changed in her heart. And she says to Mordecai, okay, go, verse 16, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Kind of interesting to talk about fasting without God. Fasting without God is kind of useless. Unless you're trying to lose weight. Fasting, try to change a situation, really is when a person says, I'm humbling myself before God. I can't do anything. So I'm going to let go of anything of importance in my life so I can have all my attention focused on God. I'm going to let go of even food and drink so that I can show God I'm serious in pursuing him. The absence of the reference to God there is louder than if he had mentioned God. We're suddenly having blaring at us this thought that, wait a minute, that makes no sense unless you're doing it to God. So they come up with a plan. Esther has a plan to go into the king's presence, and when the king receives her and gives her the grace to enter without ordering her execution, she makes a simple request and says, come to my banquet where I'll present my larger request. Oh, and bring Haman. Haman, the villain, is thrilled by this, and he thinks that this means he's even going to be more elevated. And unfortunately, as he leaves that banquet, he sees Mordecai, and his rage intensifies. And he has erected by his house a 75-foot-tall stake. I know some translations use the word gallows because that's a more modern form of execution that some might be used to hearing about. But the word is actually stake. A 75-foot-tall stake erected on which he intends to impale Mordecai. That's seven stories. Is that taller than the grain bin behind us? Someone's got a rage issue. Then you come to chapter 6. Chapter 6 is the great reversal. Chapter 6 is where this whole story hinges. In fact, if you look at all the parts leading up to chapter 6, they all have a mirror in the second half of the book. Whether it's the king's banquet, or then Mordecai's banquet, or the king's and Haman's edict, or the king and Mordecai's edict, or the banquet that Esther throws first, or the second banquet that Esther throws. In the middle, you have the great reversal. What happens? Haman goes into the king's presence hoping to get the king to agree with him that Mordecai should be killed. He wants to have permission to impale Mordecai on that stake he's erected. But as he goes into the presence, it just so happens. Coincidence. The king couldn't sleep that night. Coincidence. The king ordered someone to come in and read him the history of his kingdom. Coincidence. A person reading the chronicles of the kingdom happens to turn to the page where Mordecai's revealing of the assassination attempt against the king is talked about. Coincidence. The king asks, what was done for Mordecai when he revealed that assassination attempt and saved my life? Coincidence. And nothing was done, actually. So when Haman is brought into the king's presence, the king says, hey, Haman, what should we do for someone that the king wants to honor? And the pride of Haman causes him to lay out this elaborate scheme of how the one that king honors should be treated because he thinks it's going to be him. But after he announces his grand scheme involving horses and robes and proclamations and parades, the king says, oh, good idea. Do that to Mordecai, Haman's arch enemy. Coincidence. The God who hides, working his miracles. At the point of the greatest intensity of the story, God switches things around. When things seem to be at their darkest, things are turned. When the death of Mordecai was just right around the corner and the stake was prepared, things are flipped. And rather than going to his execution, Mordecai is led through the town in a grand royal procession with his arch enemy saying, this is how the king treats those he honors. Are you at that point? When things look really bleak and dark? Does it seem like God's not at work? Is God hiding? Or is God about to reveal his grand reversal? If you like irony in stories that flip, I encourage you to read Esther. So Mordecai is honored. Mordecai is given this great prominence. Haman is horrified. And he's scheming all the more that he has to do something to get even. But the very next thing that happens, now as we start our way back through the second half of the story, is that there's the second banquet of Esther. The king and Haman are brought into Esther's banquet, and there Esther reveals that a plot has been made to wipe out all the Jewish people, of which she is one. She reveals for the first time that she is a Jew. And the king is appalled. Who would do such an evil thing? Who would try to kill the queen and all of her people? And the queen says, that vile Haman. So in a rage, the king orders that Haman be impaled on the stake that he erected. Chapter 8 is the reversal of the edict. A new edict is written. Instead of it saying that all Jewish people should be destroyed, it now says that all Jewish people should defend themselves and have all that they need to take care of themselves in defense against their enemies. Chapter 9 says, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now things were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities to all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those who were determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were now afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai and sees them. The grand reversal. You can see why Jews throughout history have enjoyed this book. How when it seemed like every nationality was against them and the powers that be were seeking to destroy them, and it seemed like evil was triumphing, all of a sudden God intervened and God switched and God turned, and now they were given all that they needed to be successful. Sometimes God waits to the last minute. But God never forgets His promises. He promised to take care of the Jewish people. For 400 and some years after this point, the Messiah does come. If Haman's plan had succeeded, if God had not intervened, if God had stayed hidden the whole time, then the Jewish race would have been wiped out. There would be no Messiah. But God made sure that His plan of salvation for the Jewish race and all mankind would come about. He acted. And so as you turn through the rest of chapter 9, you see the establishment of a feast. A feast ironically named Purim. Purim. The die. The lot is cast. What is a feast called Purim or Purim about? It's about the sovereignty of God. Oh, sure, the evil ones might throw dice and pick dates and try to determine when's the best time to annihilate the whole race of Jewish people. But God, who might appear to be hidden, controls even dice. And if God could be trusted to control dice, if God could be trusted change the mind of a king, if God could be trusted to elevate a Jewess to be queen, if God could be trusted to put Mordecai in the right spot to expose an assassination attempt, if God could be trusted in those things, then God could be trusted in your life. God will not hide forever. God might hide long enough for you to say, God, I need you, and cry out in desperation. But when you do, God shows up. And God is at work behind the scenes. And God is doing things that seem to be beyond comprehension. The Jew who was intended to be on a stake is now the second highest in command of the whole kingdom of Persia. The queen, a Jew, is issuing edicts with the king's signet ring given to her to stamp onto them so that the Jews could defend themselves and then celebrate every year from that point forward. God is at work behind the scenes in Persia and in your life.